Preparing to delve in 3, 2, 1.
You there in the tunic. Yes, come closer, my friend.
No, I'm good. Hey, everybody. It's a wonderful sunny day out here in the Icarian Bazaar, full of fascinating characters of questionable repute.
Do you seek teleportation, enhanced self-propulsion, or transdimensional travel?
Maybe later. Ah, gnomes. Can't live with them. Anyway, I'd like to talk to you about a product a step above these merchant swayers, Battle Bards. Featuring state-of-the-art sound design, Battle Bards has the best audio for your role-playing experience. It'll make your game come alive.
Are you the saint, searching for the sound that grants everlasting life?
Not right now. Busy recording on my magical sound collector. And the sound mixer makes all your audio come together for a scene-stealing experience.
If you died whilst wearing one of these armors, you deserved it.
You just bought one. And as a listener to Delve, you can get even more audio for signing up. I'll tell you how at the end of the show. Battle Bards, hearing is believing.
These here are the finest weapons ever wrought by mortal hands.
Oh, fine, I'll take a look.
Heavy battle axes from the dwarven holds of the Iron Hill.
Oh, here we go.
Deadly leaf-backed arrow.
Yep.
The elven kingdom of Thalia.
Wow, cool.
Folded steel swords from the
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Delve. My name is Nathan.
And I'm Alex.
And, Alex, today on the show, we have somebody that knows something about small games. Do you know anything about small games yourself?
They're small, Nathan.
Thanks, Captain Obvious. So, on today's show, we are joined by the creator of Avignon, A Clash of Popes, John Dubois. John, thank you for gracing us with your presence.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I'm so excited because A Clash of Popes sounds like the Super Smash Brothers game that I never really got to play when I went to Catholic school. So I'm super happy right now. Can you tell me a little bit about the game right up at the start?
Sure. So Avignon is based on the historical Avignon Papacy, when there were two popes trying to both gain control of the Catholic Church. And so in the game, it is a two-player game, you take the role of one of the two popes, and you are trying to influence people in the church to support your bid for pope. And the way it's kind of laid out is there's a 5x5 grid, and there's characters in the grid, and you are literally pushing characters out towards your opponent or pulling in towards you, trying to get three characters to take your side before your opponent does the same thing. And it's a quick game. It takes 10-15 minutes to play. And so it's just one of those nice little filler games that you can take out while you're waiting for the people to come to the game day, or just a good spouse game at night.
I see. So it's sort of like one of those palate cleansers, you know. It's like if I'm playing something really intense at the start, I might be playing something intense in the middle. You know, I got something to kind of take me through that middle section, kind of cleanse my palate. Cool. Now, I do have to ask. The subject matter is not necessarily what I would have normally thought of for a card game. Why did you focus on Avignon?
Well, the game started out as kind of a generic tug-of-war game, and I was trying to find a theme for it. And there's a website called the Board Game Designers Forum, and every month they do a pitch contest where they give you a theme, and you have to pitch a game based on that theme in 500 words or less. And one month the theme was religious-based games. And I guessed that most people entering the contest would do something related to faith dogmas, maybe mythology, possibly even comparative religion. Mm-hmm. And I thought it would be an interesting take to try to do something historical. And this game that didn't yet have a theme fit really well with this particular moment in the history of the Catholic Church. And I pitched that theme. The replies from the other people in the forum were very positive. I didn't win that month, but it was a lot of, we like this idea, but you haven't really fleshed out how it would work well enough. And so I decided to go off in that direction.
I see. Okay.
Sounds like a very interesting concept to have a different theme every month, actually.
Yes, it does.
Something I'm going to have to look into.
Yes. Yeah, there's something for you to do in all of your free time that you apparently have. Yeah. Was that period of time something that you were familiar with before the contest, or did you do some research?
I was vaguely familiar with it. You know, I knew that it happened. I didn't really necessarily know even necessarily when it happened, but I just knew that it was, okay, sometime in the first half of the last millennium, there was this struggle between popes, and that was what I knew going in, and then I did more research as I was developing the game.
I see. Okay. Now, this is a very small game, right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's 18 cards. Some would call that a micro game if we want to put labels on it.
Yeah, I would call it that.
Okay, good. Well, we're putting a label on it ourselves. That's perfectly fine.
So you told us before you can play the game in like 10 to 15 minutes. I'm assuming it's only two player because it's only two popes.
Yep, only two player.
How does one go about designing a game that is this small, that takes up this time frame? Like, what are some things you try to avoid or you try to purposefully do when working on that?
The big thing that I try to do is I try to, when making a smaller game, make sure that the game is extremely easy to learn and teach. I mean, you're talking with this game, if it takes you 5 minutes to learn the game, it takes you half as much time to learn the game as it does to play it. And with a lot of games, that payoff, like, there's got to be a big payoff there if you're going to spend half the playtime of the game learning it. So with the game, we stuck with very simple rules. You know, you have these four actions available to you. That's all you can do the entire game. And it's just how you piece those actions together and how they interact with the different cards that does a lot of the work of getting the gameplay understood. The other thing we did is when I first designed the game, there were some character abilities that took two or three steps. You know, first you push a character, then you take a character off the board, then you do this. And the publisher and I decided that those powers were really too complicated for a game that would take this small of an amount of time, at least for the base game. And that's why you sometimes have expansions for things, so you can kind of put those more complicated elements back in. And so the challenge with a small game is you start with the game you have, and then you just cut things until you are at the absolute essence of the game. And then you see if there's anything else that worked with that essence that absolutely has to be in there.
How much did you actually end up cutting out of your original thought process before you got to the game that we have today?
The original game, before I even added the theme to it, had 15 different character abilities.
Okay.
Each card is a different character. They have their own ability, and they each have their own different way they interact with the board. We eventually cut that down to a total of six characters, and each character is represented twice in the deck. And so we went from basically 15 different things you could do to six.
Okay.
That is definitely an easy way to cut things down.
Yep.
Have you developed any other small games like this before? Or?
I am working on 20 card deduction game right now, and apart from that, those are my only really two small games. The other games I'm working on, definitely, I wouldn't call them large games, but they certainly are not this small.
I see. Okay. So when you have a game that is this small, what are the main things you have to remember when you're developing it?
The big thing that you have to remember is that you have to hook the players immediately.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a longer or larger game, I mean, if you put Battlestar Galactica in front of a group of players. You know, so this is a 4-hour game. Yeah. There's a whole trader and social interaction development aspect to it. You can tell players, okay, so the first part of the game, you're kind of feeling each other out. Then about an hour in, things start getting interesting, and they get really interesting 2 hours in. If you're working with 18 cards and 10 to 15 minutes, you don't really have the opportunity to say, well, look, it's going to get interesting. It's got to be interesting right away.
Right.
Or players are just going to play it once and then walk away.
How? So you said it takes about 5 minutes to actually learn.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's great. That's good. I have a short attention span. Squirrel. I appreciate that. Now, from the time that you actually started developing it to the time that you had the product that you eventually were able to release, what's that time frame?
It was, for this game, about a year.
And then how long did it take for them to actually publish it?
So the base concept for the game was in early 2015. The publisher signed it that July, and then the Kickstarter was in January, and it was in backers' hands in April, I think.
So overall, that seems like a pretty quick turnaround compared to some of the other games, yeah.
It's extremely fast. It was an extremely fast turnaround compared to almost any other game that I've seen get published, where I've followed the game from design through development to publication.
Yeah. We'll take Alex as an example, because I'm going to throw him into every conversation.
Okay.
A lot of the games that he comes up with that he wants to build are fairly complex. They're fairly large. And I was hoping maybe you could make your pitch for why a smaller, stripped-down game is actually better than a big, complex game.
I'm not going to make that argument for you.
Damn.
Because I don't believe in the inherent superiority of game genres over each other. You know, small games are something that I really enjoy. If the game goes over an hour, it had better be as good as Dead of Winter or Battlestar Galactica, or I will get bored.
Yeah.
My jam is really 30 minutes in, play it, done, play a different game.
Gotcha.
That said, there are a lot of people out there who really enjoy playing Diplomacy for 12 hours.
Diplomacy is a fantastically terrible game.
And I'm just not going to tell them they're wrong. You know,
if you don't like keeping friends, Diplomacy is a fantastic game to play for 12 hours.
You know, it's really right now where we are with the games industry. It's really a blessing that we just have so much space in the market for so many different games for people of different interest levels to enjoy. And I just don't see a purpose in trying to say that my style of game is better than your style of game. If we want to play different styles of games, there's room at the table for all of it.
So basically he's saying your ploy to get me to make a smaller game has failed.
I feel so sad right now.
I think that if you want to be a good game designer or a good game developer, you should try to play every kind of game at least a couple times. You know, the large format games are not my cup of tea, but I've played them. I've played enough of them to know why it is they are not my favorite kind of game. You know, but that's important knowledge to have. You know, I've played enough small games with people who don't like small games. And at a lot of the developer and designer conventions, you get people with that specific kind of feedback where people come in and say, you know, so your weird dexterity cooking game is not the kind of game that I would buy as a player or sell as a publisher. But I can see the people who like this kind of game enjoying it or not enjoying it for these reasons. And being able to take your personal preference out of the equation and being able to analyze a game for what it is and what its audience is a really important skill for a designer and a developer to have.
I would definitely agree with that. Because if you sit there and you're like, well, I don't like this, so I'm never going to try it, then you're missing a lot of the genre.
Yeah, yeah. So I mean, basically what you're saying is that everyone can be their own snowflake and we can all enjoy what we enjoy.
Right. I mean, there's no reason for us not to. It's not like the existence of Avignon means that the next diplomacy can't exist.
Ooh, that sounds fun.
It's not like the presence of one game in the market necessarily takes another different kind of game in the market. What you see more frequently is that games will displace similar games. And you know, people have the conversation of, well, this new game that I bought killed this old game that I had because it fills the same kind of play space and I like this new one better.
Mm-hmm.
So you'll see people say, I'm kind of looking at my collection to see where I did this. Oh, there's one. I sold my copy of Pandemic.
Okay.
Because I played Pandemic the Cure. And I thought the dice game version of it was a better cooperative experience in that theme for my preferences.
Oh, okay.
So that game hedged out a similar game. I never would have sold Mysterium because I got Pandemic the Cure. Because they're two very different kinds of games. You know, so Avignon isn't going to make somebody get rid of diplomacy. The only thing that'll make someone get rid of diplomacy is something else like diplomacy.
I see. Yeah.
Diplomacy on steroids.
I think I'm going to call it Bureaucracy. I'm going to make that game. that's going to be the new...
That probably exists somewhere.
It probably does. Is that where you actually bribe players so that you can win with actual money?
Well, you can technically do that in diplomacy. There's nothing in the rules against it.
Okay.
It's like the many different clones of Cards Against Humanity.
Yeah, the crabs adjust humidity and...
Cats Against Humanity. I think that's one.
All I don't think it's a game. I think it's just the natural state of cats.
Oh, well, yeah. It's probably a little bit of both. Yeah, no, there's a million clones of it because they took Cards Against Humanity, which itself is pretty much a clone of, yeah, I think, Apples to Apples.
Yeah.
And just reskinned for more adult themes. Then other people went, oh, that's great, and it sells like crazy, so we're going to make clones, and then Cards Against Humanity is just like, you know what, that's fine. They're unofficial expansions, basically. Use them with it.
Yeah. The best bad Cards Against Humanity clone was when Mattel tried to make adult Apples to Apples.
Oh, goodness. Was it terrible?
I will say this. I never played it. I saw it on a store shelf. I kind of shook my head, and I walked away. Yeah. It certainly didn't generate the same number of sales.
I know. I think
I'll put it this way. Of the two games, one of them is currently in Target, and it isn't adult Apples to Apples.
That's one of those things you think, Mattel, don't they make Barbies? Why are they doing this?
Yeah.
It's not really the people you would think would make a game like that, and it's not their target audience, I feel like.
Well, and they do make board games. I mean, Apples to Apples is certainly what Mattel would do, and certainly what Mattel does is find a small company that makes something super successful and pays them lots of money for it, and that's how they got Apples to Apples in the first place.
That is fair. That is how a lot of gaming, especially video gaming, works.
Yeah. I just personally find it fascinating that so they had Apples to Apples, and then Cards Against Humanity basically makes an adult version of that, and then Apples and Apples wants to basically do what Cards Against Humanity did, make a version of that, and then they can't compete with the thing that was a version of the thing that they made to begin with.
Yeah, I think that was the order. I mean, the order also could have been, and I don't know because I don't really do adult party games, but maybe the adult Apples to Apples came first, and the Cards Against Humanity folks were like, this is terrible, we can do better than this.
That might also be true. Was there any particular influences, since we're talking about games influencing other games, when you made Avignon, were you keeping an eye to any other games as a reference point?
Not directly. I mean, obviously, whenever I was working on it, I was thinking of other, you know, gridded movement games. You know, a lot of the ideas about pieces having their own special abilities, that's, you know, chess. But in terms of looking to a game for direct influence, I didn't really see anything in the market at the time that was doing the kind of thing specifically that Avignon was doing. You had your small format kind of pieces move games. You had Hive, which did some of that. But the tiles versus the cards made it different enough that I didn't feel like it was a great analog. You know, now you've got Onitama, which is similar in a lot of ways. But the two games were developed mostly in parallel. I had never heard of Onitama until after Avignon was already out.
Oh, okay. Now, since you mentioned chess, which is a pure strategy game, just as interested in the actual setup of the game, does each player have the same set of cards in their hand or to draw from?
So the two players have, it's open information. At the start of the game, there are five characters out on the board. But all five characters are available to both players to use.
Okay.
And so it's not like chess in that you have one pope's pieces and another pope's pieces, but it's like chess in that the pieces in the board have their own special movement ability. Like, for example, in Avignon, they're called petition abilities. If you were to petition a bishop, you would get to pull a bishop one space towards you, then your opponent would get to pull a different piece one space towards them. Okay. Whereas if you were to petition the knight, you would push two other spit pieces towards your opponent one space, and then you get to pull the knight twice.
Okay, I see.
And so that's kind of where the chess analog is, and that each piece has its own own thing. But okay. Unlike chess, and this makes it a little more random, a little less strategic, the characters that you start on the board with are random from game to game. You know, it's a 12-card deck of characters, and you only start with five characters and play at a time.
All right, okay. So there is a slight element of luck in there, mixed with the strategy.
There's a minor element of luck. In terms of the game setup, I would refer to it more as randomness than luck, because luck implies that it is beneficial to one player over the other, where randomness is just, this is how it is, and it treats both players fairly, if that makes sense.
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Yeah, I get that. So, are you generally a fan of more strategic games or more of the randomness games, if we're using that term?
For me, the game has got to have equal pieces of both. Anything that is pure strategy, we've got a guy in our game group. And the way we say it is, don't ever play a game with Scott unless it has dice. because yeah, if it is a game without dice, Scott will figure out how to win, and he will figure out a more optimal strategy than what you have, and you will lose the game to Scott. And so we have, you know, everyone's got their games where we're like, if you want to play a game with Scott and you don't want to lose to Scott, you should play these games. If you don't mind losing to Scott, you can go play Power Grid with him.
did Scott get to play Avignon?
I don't know if Scott played Avignon. I don't remember. It's one of those things where my game group has a lot of adults with children, and some of the children are very busy, and some of the adults are very busy, and I honestly don't know if he was over on one of the days that I was playtesting.
And if he was, he would have won. And
oh, he would have creamed me. I mean, this is—it's one of those things where the designers joke that they know the game is good when they lose at it.
Right.
And if that's the case, then Avignon was a good game, like almost from minute one, because I lost the game frequently. I have never won the physical game of Avignon against my wife. There is an app in development for it. On the beta of the app, I could beat her. And according to her, that's evidence that the app is broken and still needs to be have some bugs ironed out, because obviously it's not working right if I won. But no, I've never beaten my wife at this game.
That's interesting, because... That's interesting. I find that fascinating, because I always figure that a game developer is like the one that sees the matrix of the game, and if Neo can't, always beat Agent Smith, then it doesn't register for me. So I find that fascinating myself.
I mean, it really is. Like I said, unless it's a deep strategy game, and this is something that I've started recently listening to. Mark Rosewater's podcast, one of the lead developers in Magic.
Oh, cool.
And one of the things he talks about is how, as a developer, you can try to anticipate different combinations. And obviously, he's working with 10,000 cards. There's a lot more combinations than anything I would ever make. But he said no amount of playtesting can match up to what is going to happen once 1,000 people get a hold of your game and try to do things with it on their own.
Yeah.
No matter what the game is. I could run 100 playtests, and if that game hits store shelves and 1,000 people buy that game and play it once, that is 10 times as many games as my playtests were.
Yeah.
And... There's just no way to account for that. I mean, you can play test a lot, you can iterate a lot, you can work out what you think the bugs are, and then somebody picks up the game and sees something that you never saw. And it comes up a lot in Magic with cards that have to get banned, but you see it happen in board games too. It happened with A Few Acres of Snow. Is that they got the one? There was one strategy thing they called the Halifax Hammer. That once somebody figured out this strategy, it was an unbeatable strategy, and it was something that the designer, who was a pretty big game designer, had just never encountered or thought of in any of his playtests.
I'm just trying to think of the Halifax Hammer now. That sounds fantastic.
Yeah,
what is that anyway?
I don't know.
It sounded good.
I've never played the game. It's one of those things that you pick up just as people talk at conventions, and they have their war stories about what players did to their games that they didn't think of, and that was one of them. Was just it's an apparently unbeatable strategy in this war game.
Huh. Interesting. So it was Halifax Warhammer, and 40K.
It was a game about. Oh, and I'm going to feel like a bad history student because I don't remember whether it was the Revolutionary War or the War of 1812. But it was a card-based war game, and there was just this particular strategy. I'm guessing it involved the city of Halifax in some way because it was called the Halifax Hammer.
Guessing, yeah.
And it was just something that I guess was a very dominant strategy. And the designer... either didn't agree or didn't care, because when he made the second edition, he didn't change anything.
I'm just going to let people continue doing this, because whatever. It's fine.
Everything's good. I'm going to be laying that Halifax hammer down on your head. No one cares. Alex's head is actually very hammerable. Most people don't know that. So we have more with John Dubois, and we will get to that on the next episode, where we talk about his publishing company and some things to know about publishing games in general. Until that time, though, you can always find more episodes of Delve at delvecast.com. That's right, delvecast.com. It's catching. And you can also find more information about Avignon on buttonshygames.com. A wonderful array of small pocket-sized games there as well. Not just Avignon, although I would suggest you look there. You can also find more information about the game at BoardGameGeek.com. For us, in addition to finding us on thedelvecast.com, you can also find us on iTunes, you can also find us on Google Play, you can find us on Twitter. I am at Citanium, Alex is at EXP Limited, the show is at Delve Podcast, so we got all that going for us. If you would like to, perchance, email us, if you are a potential guest, or if you have a question for us, please do that. Our email is delvepodcast@gmail.com, and we will try and stay in contact with you, or you can find us on Twitter as well, and get in touch with us that way. So, until next time, where we get more Popey, we're going to sign out for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you next time. Bye. You have been listening to Underground Lake City, Lightness Shores by Richard Daskus, available on BattleBards. We thank BattleBards for sponsoring Delve. Go to BattleBards.com, create an account, make your first purchase, and during checkout, use coupon code DELVE1 for $10 and $25 packages to get a free track, DELVE2 on $50 and $100 packages to get 5 tracks, or DELVE3 for $150 and $300 packages to get 10 tracks. That's like getting a full album for free just by using the code. BattleBards.com, you'll love it.